אתם עם SBS בעברית. לעוד סיפורים מעניינים, כנסו ל-sbs.com.au.
Zara Cooper is a former corporate lawyer and former CEO and co-founder of a global company. Like most people in the Jewish community, she was left shocked and horrified with the attacks that happened in Israel last year. What was more shocking and horrifying was the proliferation of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic sentiment that became increasingly ubiquitous in Australia. It's because of this that Zara became an activist, originally calling out bigots on Instagram, and then subsequently she founded the Digital Defence, an advocacy group which has aims of becoming a leading authority in online safety. Yes, the impetus starts with Jewish people getting doxxed in the public sphere, but Zara intends for Digital Defence to be the reflexive go-to for any vulnerable community or person who has experienced online harmful conduct. Another interesting aspect of Zara is her personal life, and with a quick Google search, you can see it's the main theme that is associated with her. She's astonishingly revealing about this part of her life, and the interview will open up with her explaining her personal story before she discusses her professional pursuits in the second half of the interview. Welcome, Zara Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
You are a wildly interesting person. Tell us about your personal life, because on first glance, and I don't mean to diminish you in any way at all because I think you're a remarkable person, but your personal story tends to precede everything whenever I look at you online. The Daily Mail's written about you, Mamma Mia's written about you. It's a phenomenal story. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up in Melbourne, had a really stock standard, happy childhood, went to a Jewish day school, a pretty religious one at that. Absolutely loved it. Grew up with two sisters. My parents moved to Australia in 1976 and they came here with my big sister, who was 4 years old at the time. One suitcase between the three of them and, you know, got cracking straight away. Worked so hard. My beautiful grandmother moved here a couple of years later and helped with the childcare side of things once my younger sister and I were born.
Where do they all move from?
Ukraine. Well, at the time, interestingly enough, it was the Soviet Union, obviously. So I actually grew up being told, thinking and identifying as Russian. I grew up Russian. I speak Russian fluently, read, write, always was, you know, considered myself part of the Russian community, secondary to being Australian. It was only once the war with the Ukraine broke out that I realized that I'm actually Ukrainian. They came from the Ukraine. So they weren't allowed to learn Ukrainian. They weren't allowed to identify as Ukrainian. And so that sort of just filtered through. It wasn't a discussion that they had with us. We just knew we were Russian. So until recently, I was Russian. Now I'm Ukrainian.
What an identity crisis. My God.
One of many.
Wow.
I met my high school sweetheart when I was in year 12, my now ex-husband, and we were together for 20 years, married for, I think, almost 13 of those, and had three amazing children who, I don't want to be one of those mums, so I'll stop, but yeah, three incredible kids, three blessings, and yeah, so once I had my third, something happened to me that I never thought would happen. It was this feeling like I'm done having kids. So my entire life, from when I was a toddler myself, there was this visceral need in me to be a mum. Whenever anyone would ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would say a mother, 100% of the time. That's what I wanted. And every time I would have one of my babies, I'd be like, oh, this isn't it. There's more to come, you know. But after I had my third, I still felt, yep, I definitely want more. But a few months later, something in me started to shift. And it started off with this feeling of, I think I'm done. And there's something about me that chapter's closed. And now there's something in me. It's hard to explain, but I'll take it a step back and say that throughout my childhood years, my adolescence primarily, there was something about me that I just didn't feel normal. I guess that's the way to describe it. You know, we'd go to parties, do the normal teenage things, and I just felt like I wasn't like everyone else. Like people would be hooking up and doing these things, and it grossed me out. It didn't work for me. It didn't feel right. And when I met my ex-husband for the first time, it's not that it felt 100% right, but it didn't feel wrong and gross. And he's a beautiful man. And, you know, we developed this incredible friendship and love and, you know, had all these amazing years together, but something never felt right. And magically, once I started feeling like I'm done having children, that scratched its way to the surface unintentionally. It just came up. And so I had a platonic best friend at the time, a woman, also a mother of three children. And something about this friendship fundamentally started to shift at the same time. Little did I know that similar feelings were happening within her too. But, you know, I found myself going to school pickup and waiting outside the school and being conscious of, has she come yet? Looking in my rearview mirror. It was bizarre. I was like, why do I care? Why am I all of a sudden so conscious of her presence and lack of it? And it kept developing, and this went on for about a year. You know, I started,
oh my God.
Started telling my friends and my family and even my ex-husband, I don't know what's going on. This is just, it's really weird. I can't.
Was it not apparent to you that you had a full-on crush?
No. That's the thing. No, because even though things never felt right, I had never until that point felt anything crush-like for a woman, and I didn't see it as that at all. I mean, right. The two of us had this, like, electricity between us, and we'd spent hours. It was my best friend, so that's not unusual, but it just started to feel different. I didn't know that it was the same for her. So I sort of explored this in my own mind, as I do. I internally process things before I'm ready to communicate them. But, yeah, one time we were sort of sitting outside in my backyard, and I won't go into the conversation because it breaches her privacy, but it came out in that conversation that the feeling was mutual. And we sort of went on a journey because at that point, to me, that didn't translate to sexual feelings. It was just this crush-like infatuation. And to be honest, we weren't in the same place because for me, it was something I wasn't going to hide. It was something I was very open about from the outset and something I was willing to explore and understand better. And she, I understand, was not in the same place. And so it wasn't something that we actually explored. But I just remember thinking to myself, it's all about her, but I don't think it's all about her. I think there's something more to this. And I sat down with both her and my husband on a Friday, separately, not together.
Okay.
And I explained where I was coming from, and this has gotten so big. And I think this is not about you, this is about me, and it's something I have to understand because it's just, it doesn't go away. It's been 4 years now, and it's just growing and growing, and it's gotten bigger than anything I imagined.
At this point, was it apparent to you that you were in love with her?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And we'd express that to each other.
Okay.
Yes, it was. And I had that conversation on the Friday, and then on the Sunday, I took my youngest to a kindergarten party and met the love of my life. And now 5 years later, we're getting married in a few months' time. And she is literally the person I have shared every lifetime with. We have gone through every solar system, every anything you can define as spiritual realms that are outside of, you know, our physical. Like, I never believed in any of that till I met her. And it's this bizarre feeling like she's always been inside me and she was just always there. And I had to go through particular things in life, I think, because I wanted kids so badly. And that was so fundamentally part of who I was. I had blinkers on for the lifestyle that I thought would achieve that. And I didn't even know that. It wasn't a conscious decision. It's just that my brain didn't allow anything else in until magically I was done having kids. And then something in me opened up and I had to go through all of what I went through to meet her and to be the person I am now with her. Yeah, she's amazing. And so I discovered myself, who I've always been, who I am and who I want to be through my relationship with her. And it's just lucky me. She feels the same.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, it's just it's a real soulmate thing. I used to think that term was so, you know, cliched and so cringeworthy, but I feel really blessed because I have a really amicable relationship with my ex-husband.
Yeah.
We're really good friends. Our kids are still our kids. We still have a joint account, joint credit cards that we split the costs for them. We parent them together. You know, when he drops them off, he comes in, sits down, hangs out with my partner. And I feel really lucky that my choice to be honest and true to who I am didn't destroy everybody's lives like everybody told me it would, you know?
I'm sure you had your warnings.
Yeah, I had. And I still have. you know, some people don't subscribe to the gay lifestyle. They use many other excuses to cover up that opinion, which is, you know, you broke a family up and you've, you know, but the irony is my kids are happier now than they've ever been.
Wow.
And
How does it logistically work with, like, you know, you've got your kids...
Yep.
100% of the time, or are you sharing custody?
I have three, and my partner has two.
Right.
We both share custody week on, week off. So we have all five kids for 1 week.
Oh,
and
my
then
God.
We have no kids.
Trip Beverly
week.
Hills.
Totally. Gaty Bunch.
Yeah.
Gaty Bunch. And that's what we call ourselves. But it's amazing.
As long as the kids are on board, anything goes.
They love each other. Yeah. We're, again, so lucky. They are like long-lost siblings.
Wow.
My son is the only boy in my family in around seven generations, and my partner has two boys. So now he's got two brothers that he's always wanted. And I said this to my kids. If you are true to yourself, if you live your truth, but you do so with kindness and consideration for those around you, things fall into place. And that's, I think, a lesson I feel fortunate to have actually embodied, shown them through my own experience. And I want them to be their true selves too. I think that's the greatest gift a person can
have. Absolutely. And you're modeling your truth on them as well, so they can always reference you whenever it feels. Because truth can be a really fickle thing to deal with as well. As noble as it sounds, you know, you can lose friends, you can lose family, you can lose really special people in your life if you're being too true to yourself.
Yep.
And you're lucky that it didn't end up being too cataclysmic with your husband when you decided to deliver the news to him as well, and that you've somehow maintained this miraculously great relationship.
I think there were definitely moments where heartbreak can get in the way, and frustration and sadness and anger can make people do silly things. And
absolutely.
I think the fact that my parents went through a pretty awful divorce, and we sort of as kids saw that for 3 years.
Mm.
I made a promise to myself that I'll never let my kids go through that same experience.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him straight off the bat, we need to make a vow that no matter how hard things get right now, when everything, and by the way, when we separated, this was just before COVID hit.
Mm.
So everything turned upside down in all our worlds at the same time. And I said, no matter how hard things get,
mm-hmm.
we have to remain committed to keeping things amicable for the kids' sake.
Do you feel gay now that you are technically gay, or do you just feel like you are yourself? Are you doing things differently, or is it just maintaining the same lifestyle? You just happen to be engaged to a woman.
I just feel like myself. I don't feel like gay. I just feel I definitely am gay. Like, and I've discovered that over the years through loving her, through knowing her, I've discovered myself. I am very gay.
This was also her first foray into.
No, she was with a woman before me.
Oh,
she's been
I see.
With women since she was a teenager. So she's known that about herself.
So interesting that you're the one that drove this, not her.
Well, we met and it was instant. It was both of us. Like, we made, like you see, tacky, all that movie stuff. That's what it was. Like, we made eye contact, and really that was it. The rest is history.
I want to shift now to your professional life. You've been a corporate lawyer for most of it, but you are doing some real riveting things at the moment. You've got an active Instagram account, and you've started a company called digitaldefence.org. Can you tell me about them both?
We have zero online safety in Australia, and that needs to change. Digital Defence essentially is all about creating online safety in Australia. And how that's come about is when I myself was doxxed, I had to go through the system. So I drafted an 18-page chronology in the form of like a brief to counsel because of my legal background, which clearly stipulated the conduct. I transcribed all the doxing posts, had screenshots, included the thousands of messages, death threats, threats against my children, you know, tagging and boycotting of my business. The spread of this, I can't even explain to you, the hacking attempts on three of my accounts. Like, it was relentless. I'd get 100 emails in 2 minutes of hacking attempts. My business partner as well. It was relentless. And so I categorized it all and took it to law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
saying about, you know, this law in the criminal code, this is in breach of that. Hit a brick wall. They had no idea what I was talking about. And evidently, you could see they had zero interest in looking into it anyway and just wanted to fob it off. Maybe this is defamation, as they all say. And I said, actually, defamation is civil. This is illegal conduct. Here's the particular act that it's in breach of. And they weren't interested. So my next port of call was to go to the eSafety Commissioner because that's their very purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately opened the Online Safety Act and read what the law, which empowers the eSafety Commissioner, which is the Online Safety Act, what it allows them to do. And currently, all it allows them to do is take down the post. And anyone who uses social media knows that these perpetrators usually put it up in stories, which disappear in 24 hours.
Okay.
And within that time frame, the damage that is done in that 20, and I bore witness to that myself, you can't measure it. And so by the time you've then submitted the report to the eSafety Commissioner, essentially they can do nothing.
Well,
and that was the conclusion.
You take a screenshot of any of these 24-hour stories that go up and then it lives on.
It lives on. But all they can do in response to that is remove a post that no longer exists. So it was really problematic. So when I waded through the system with all my legal experience, with all my, you know, I saw that there actually was nothing in place to provide online safety to people like myself who had been doxed, harassed, and to penalise perpetrators who had literally breached Australian laws. And that's what inspired me to go, something needs to be done about this. And that's how Digital Defence was born. I'm one of the co-founders, and from my angle, that's how Digital Defence was born.
And does it extend to the non-Jewish community as well?
Online safety is not about the Jewish community or any particular community. It's about every community. It's about all Australians. I am here fighting for online safety for all Australians. I don't prioritise anybody. Of course, we need to give special attention to people who are more at risk and vulnerable communities. But this is about online safety for everyone. It's about making this country safer for all Australians, because in my opinion, social media and the online space is the epicenter of all the vile conduct that we have seen happening in Australia in the last 14 months. And as you can see, a lot of it translates to in real life as well. But to me, social media and online is the epicenter of it.
An adjacent question to you, how do you feel about the banning of social media use for under 16s?
That's a really complex one. I don't think that's the answer. I don't think the government telling parents, making decisions on behalf of parents is the answer. It is up to the government to enforce the laws that we have and to create a safe online space in the first place. So it's not dangerous for teenagers to be online. It's up to platforms to have more accountability. There are so many problems with the platforms as well. And what happens when you turn 16? I mean, all of the online abuse and harassment that I have witnessed in the last 14 months that form the case studies that, you know, are the sort of foundation of Digital Defence, it's almost 100% adult-to-adult behaviour. A lot of this horrific online behaviour involves adults. So this doesn't solve the problem. This basically allows the government to pass the buck, check a box and say, hey, look how great we are. We're protecting our kids. But actually, you're not, because you're not doing anything to make the online space safe in the first place.
Tell me what your potential solution for this is.
When you try and say, I've got a solution to this huge problem, which is the lack of online safety, it almost is an insurmountable notion. But so what
it's
we've
done...
It's
not a silver bullet. I know that you've got
definitely
some ideas.
So what we've done is we've identified the five biggest problem areas. And this is based on not only our personal experience, but that of hundreds of people. We've collected a lot of data. We have our own surveys. We're working with tons of different communities, minority groups, people, you know, Australia-wide, other organisations. We're not about reinventing the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
We're about using what already exists and bringing it together into a workable system that's accessible to the end user, people who go online. So we've broken it down into sort of five campaigns, if you will, of the most problematic areas. And we've spent the last 12 months now brainstorming solutions. So first, it's gathering the data and seeing the exact extent of the problem from many different people's perspectives, and then brainstorming the solutions. And amazingly, we've I've been working with several government departments already, high-level organisations and the media on
bringing about the changes that we're proposing. And we've had a really, really good success rate. So there are a lot of exciting things in store for next year. I think once you break it down, I mean, because when you start to talk about AI, algorithm, once you lump it into one big thing, it becomes almost impossible to know how to deal with it. And so we just keep breaking it down, tackling one thing at a time because you have to start somewhere.
Absolutely. And I mean, and now that you've mentioned algorithms, I do want to say that it's because of the algorithms that a lot of people stay in these echo chambers as well. And that's pretty much what keeps pressing down on their original beliefs of whatever they do believe in. And that's what bifurcates our society. So it is quite dangerous, social media. And look, this is not a subject I know much about at all. I'm barely on socials myself, but it's very scary being a parent like you are.
Yeah. So with algorithms, that's in our platform accountability campaign. And it's not just algorithms. You know, there are so many irresponsible tools they use to monetize absolutely everything. And it's just allowed all of these toxic behaviors to fester, not just allowed, promoted them, this tribalism, gang mentality. And when you couple that with a government and law enforcement who aren't enforcing laws that are designed to protect people from the ill effects of all of that, well, you've got like a Wild West or a jungle type situation. And like I say, you're putting a Band-Aid on it by saying, okay, well, no one under 16 can go on that anymore. It doesn't begin to solve the issue. And so that's exactly what we're focused on. I think at the end of the day, it's about creating the types of penalties where the punishment fits the crime, and where what we don't have at the moment is where everything that exists is purely reactive. We need to start creating a system where it's preventative, where it'll prevent that conduct in the first place. And that's very much what we're focused on.
I was going to ask you right before we wrap up, just in terms of bullying, cyberbullying, in-person bullying, do you think it's a real problem when it's legitimized or laundered, even when it's coupled with an anti-racist bend? People sort of disguising themselves as being holier than thou, but actually inverting racism to be racist to someone else?
100%. I think what I've seen almost without exception over the last 14 months is the very people who consider themselves, you know, the most progressive, the feminists of the world, the queers, the social justice activists, all these people who I genuinely thought I was on the same night as, they're the worst perpetrators. It's like they actually have become the fascists they say they're fighting against. These are the people who, in the name of their cause, and that cause continues to change, and that cause continues to absorb more causes within to this greater cause, you know, anything they do in the name of this cause is justified. So it's okay for them to harass and dox you and bully you online because they're virtuous and you're not. And they decide that you're not, and they are. It's just ridiculous.
Because you do hear this stuff where they preface a sentence with saying, as a person, as a man, insert whatever you want to insert there, but that almost gives them that credibility.
God, we could talk for hours about all of these, identity politics and DEI and all the things that really tie into this whole movement, made it into what it is. But I think the fact of the matter is that these people who consider themselves the do-gooders of society at the moment, I'm seeing, they are the worst perpetrators. And in terms of the case studies we're seeing at Digital Defence, their names are the ones that are coming up the most.
So what drives them?
That's also a really long conversation. I think it's really complex about, you know, the breakdown of society, the breakdown of, you know, the secularization, the removal of the institution of marriage, these fundamental shifts that our society's been undergoing. And then, of course, there's more nefarious things at play underneath all that as well. But I think what drives them is this very twisted ideology. And I think it always existed, or it's existed for a really long time, and I didn't even know about it. You know, I thought I was on the same side as these people, but I think this twisted ideology has been brewing underneath the surface for a really long time, and I think it's come out and revealed itself.
Sarah Cooper, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks. עקבו אחרינו והפיצו אותנו דרך דף הפייסבוק שלנו.